I'm Jean Miller. I've been here four times, so I didn't think I needed to stand up, but I'm your speaker for today. Congratulations to all of you for being here on this first day of daylight saving time. And also for being here to hear one more sermon on end of life. You began this service and the series with the topic of grief. And the last week I was here and you covered conversations at the end of life with Tuesday with Maury. And today we're going to cover conversations before the end of life. My emphasis will be on living as well as we can now. According to Fra Giovanni Giocondo, no heaven can come to us unless our hearts rest in today. No peace lies in the future, which is not hidden in this present little instant. Let us worship together.
I am very pleased to be welcoming Jean Miller, who is a thanatologist. I've never met a thanatologist before. Very exciting. It's an expert in the end of life. And she's also a retired dean of nursing at the University of Rhode Island, my alma mater. So I'm very happy to welcome Jean, and I look forward to hearing you.
Thank you, Amber. The biggest events in our lives are our birth and our death. Others prepare for our birth, but we can prepare and plan for our deaths. Unfortunately, most in American society don't want to talk about dying, even though it's going to happen to every one of us. This last week, someone asked me what I was up to, and I said I was going to be doing this, and this man in his 70-something said, you know, I've put out a book in my living room, it's about dying, and I put it out there so my kids would see it and talk to me about it. Do you think they will even lift up the book? There have been no takers whatsoever. But I want to stress that it's so much easier to make plans for death when death is not imminent. And when our loved one is not actively dying. There's one person I'm told that said at Thanksgiving time, right before the meal, I'm going to update you on my plans for dying. And there'll be no turkey until we talk turkey. So the major things that need to be discussed before dying or before the end of life are advanced directives, preference for the care of our bodies at the time of death, and our wishes in regard to our funeral or memorial services, as well as our estate and financial plans. So I encourage you to attend the workshop here at the church on end-of-life planning on March 25th with Reverend Betty, Dr. Rubenstein, who was my doctor and is a great teacher, a hospice representative and a representative from the Funeral Consumers Alliance of Rhode Island. And I have been in on those talks too, and they compare the costs of funerals at different places. And it's just excellent what they bring. And then on April Fool, not meaning to be April Fool's Day, but Marcia Boyd will lead a workshop on financial affairs, and I would highly recommend that to all of you. Now, many of you may have taken care of these tasks already, but it's wise to keep updating your wishes as needed. When preparing this talk, I realized that I needed to update my advance directives, and I needed two people to sign the form that I'd gotten from the web. And so Reverend Betty and Helene Gersony signed my advance directives. Now, these tasks that I've just described are very important. But there's something more important than all of this. It has to do with family relationships. Carrie Egan, a hospice chaplain, was asked by CNN what she had observed to be most important to people when they were dying. Her answer is so relevant to my talk that I have to read parts of it to you. Mostly, they talk about their families, about their mothers and fathers, their sons and daughters. They talk about the love they felt and the love they gave. Often they talk about love they did not receive or the love they did not know how to offer, the love they withheld or maybe never felt for the ones they should have loved unconditionally. They talk about how they learned what love is and what it is not. People talk to chaplains about their families because that is how we talk about God. That is how we talk about the meaning of our lives. That is how we talk about the big spiritual questions of human existence. We don't live our lives in our heads, in theology or in theories. We live our lives in our families. The families we were born into, the families we create, the families we make through the people we choose as friends. This is where we create our lives. This is where we find meaning. This is where our purpose becomes clear. Family is where we first experience love and where we first give it. It's probably the first place we've been hurt by someone we love, and hopefully the place we learn that love can overcome even the most painful rejection. This crucible of love is where we start to ask those big spiritual questions and ultimately where they end. We don't learn the meaning of our lives by discussing it. It's not to be found in books or lecture halls or even churches or synagogues or mosques. It is discovered through these actions of love. If God is love and we believe that this is true, then we learn about God when we learn about love. The first and usually the last classroom of love is the family. Sometimes that love is not only imperfect, it seems to be missing entirely. Monstrous things can happen in families. Too often, more often than I want to believe possible, patients tell me what it feels like when the person you love beats you or rapes you. They tell me what it feels like to know that you are utterly unwanted by your parents. They tell me what it feels like to be the target of someone's rage. They tell me what it feels like to know that you abandon your children, or that you are drinking, destroying your family, or that you failed to care for those who needed you. Even in these cases, I am amazed at the strength and resilience of the human soul. People who did not know love in their families know that they should have been loved. They somehow know what was missing and what they deserved as children and adults. We don't have to use words of theology to talk about God. People who are close to death almost never do. We should learn from those who are dying that the best way to teach our children about God is by loving each other wholly. This is a beautiful story. But I removed some parts of it because I felt it set up expectations for end-of-life experiences that were too perfect. We have to be careful about projecting Hallmark moments into ourselves and to those around us before and at the end of life. People die the way they live. If they are surrounded by loved ones, there is a reason for this. If they are alone and lonely, there is a reason for this too. I don't mean to sound heartless, but it's a more realistic picture of what life has been about. If there are issues in the family, we need to be careful about resolution before the family members dies. It may be possible, and it may not be possible. Empty apologies from the dying may not comfort those who have been wounded. Our families may or may not be the place where we first experience love, but it often is the last place we hope for love. It's important to think about what's possible and what isn't possible. We need to set ourselves and our loved ones up for things that we need to avoid setting ourselves up for things that may or may not happen. At the basic place, these final conversations need to be honest. So, how can we remove these barriers to satisfying end-of-life conversations? We can begin by being honest now, before the end of life. We are loved and we are wounded by our families. The truth of this grows as end-of-life conversations come nearer. There's a limit to what we can realistically do and expect, but we can do the best that we can without judgment. We can be direct about the specifics of what happened to make us question our family members' love for us. We need, though, to come to the place where we can say to our family member, in spite of all that has happened between us, I will honor your life in its humanness. Anything that is going to be possible has to begin with what is. This may be a source of great joy in some families and not in others. My dad and I grew to have different religious beliefs. This was difficult because our spirituality was the most important part for each of us. We would argue and end the conversations feeling yucky. Finally, we agreed to disagree, and whenever either of us slipped our beliefs into the conversation, we noted it, and finally we were able to laugh about what had just happened. This was a gift and a major milestone in our relationship. Finally, we can ask for help. It's rare that a family can navigate all of this without help. Your pastor can assist you, as well as trusted counselors and therapists. The rewards for this kind of family work are great. Being part of a family that is able to realistically and honestly express their love to a dying family member is a very beautiful experience. And we can work toward that end now, before death comes. In summary, we can plan now for the end of our lives, regardless of our age or health status, by taking care of our business out of love for ourselves and for those who are dear for us. Our final and greatest gift, though, will be our loving relationships and the quality of our conversations before and at the time of death. This is supported in the words of 1 Corinthians 13:13. And now faith, hope, and love abide, these three, and the greatest of these is love. Leo Boscali said it in this way: to live in love is to live in life, and to live in life is to live in love. Thank you. Thank you for choosing that song. It summarized the sermon to a T. Our task, according to Rumi, is not to seek love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within ourselves that we have built against it. As our barriers lift, my prayer is that we will more fully know the love that we desire, and the love that is described by Andrew Cohen in the following way. We can understand love either from the perspective of what it is or what it is not. Love is the uplifting experience of joy, ecstasy, fulfillment, contentment, delight, and abandon. Love is not the experience, the painful experience, of fear, doubt, suspicion, jealousy, obsession, and attachment. More than anything else, I think the highest expression of love, of true love, is trust. Indeed, trust is love's sweetest gift. That is because trust gives rise to an experience that ordinary love cannot: freedom and space. In fact, trust is the powerful experience of spiritual freedom within the context of human relationship. May we all be blessed now as we continue to grow in our relationships with the divine, with ourselves, and with one another. Go in peace. Amen.